Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with revelations in Monday's New York Times that for decades, Afghan President Karzai has been receiving tens of millions in secret monthly cash payments from the CIA. Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, joins us to discuss where the money went and what the U.S. got in exchange for these payments of taxpayer money. Then we will speak with a former CIA station chief in Kabul, Afghanistan, Graham Fuller, who is the author of The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. We will discuss the legacy of our recent intervention in Iraq, which appears poised to resume in a civil war, and Afghanistan, where after the U.S. withdrawal in 2014, the country will likely revert to civil war. Having riled up 1 billion Muslims from our failed and futile interventions in Muslim lands, we will examine the possibility of future blowback. Then finally, in remarks today on the 150th anniversary of the National Academy of Sciences, President Obama promised to protect science research from politics at a time when Lamar Smith, the Texas Republican who is chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, is demanding that the National Science Foundation justify its research. John Cohen, who is a correspondent with Science Magazine and author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos, joins us to discuss the latest anti-intellectual assault on science. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And Monday's New York Times has a front page story revealing how the CIA paid bags, satchels, knapsacks full of cash to Hamid Karzai over a considerable period of time, while at the same time, Karzai, of course, is double-dipping, getting cash from the Iranians. So what did we get for the cash, do you know?
Yeah, so we should clarify, to the best of our knowledge, he's no longer taking cash from the Iranians. When that story broke, I think that a few years ago, the Iranians stopped sending cash to Hamid Karzai. To the best of our knowledge, it's not clear that Karzai himself had pocketed any of the cash, but instead what we think has happened is that he's used those monies to pay off the so-called warlords. So, for example, individuals like Dostum allegedly are receiving something on the order of $100,000 a month. Some people will lowball that estimate. Some people say that $100,000 is too high. But whatever it is, it's going to be a large figure, perhaps, in that order of magnitude. And so, you know, essentially what Karzai operates, or at least he's supposed to operate, and that's part of our understanding with him, is a patronage network. And this patronage network, there are people who are important for regime stability. You want to buy people off so that they're not doing things that they would otherwise be doing. And all of this just takes money to make sure that Karzai remains there alive in that position. This isn't so terribly different from what the Soviets did actually with Najibullah. And to really have an appreciation for how important these patronage payments are to warlords, potential rivals, and as well as to allies that you want to continue to have as allies. When the Soviet Union stopped providing Najibullah with those fundings, basically his regime collapsed. He was able to stay in place for several years, actually, even after the Soviet troops withdrew. What was central to regime survival was, in fact, those payments. So this isn't entirely new. Historians of Afghanistan certainly should not be surprised. I would have been surprised if we weren't making those funds available so that Karzai could pay off his allies and nemesis alike.
Well, of course, Karzai himself, to the surprise of many, on Monday at the presidential palace, came out and made a statement that the CIA cash had been used for different purposes, such as operations, assisting wounded Afghan soldiers, and paying rent. I guess he's putting a good face on it, right?
I mean, I don't see any reason why he should, in any way. I don't understand what his incentive would be to deny getting these funds. You know, in some sense, the CIA has been paying for a whole lot of things in Afghanistan. You may recall a number of years back, there was quite the fiasco when it was learned that the CIA had also been paying his brother down in Kandahar, who was the poppy kingpin, even while the DEA was investigating him. So this is sort of old news, at least to this reader.
And that was the brother who was killed by one of his disgruntled bodyguards.
Exactly.
And who was basically, the word gangster comes to mind, warlord, whatever. I mean, the guy that...
Well, since he was working with us, of course, we called Ahmed Wali Karzai a strong man.
A strong man,
one of my favorite nomenclatures. When we don't like them, they're warlords, but when we work with them, they're strong men.
Well, and the other strong man we work with, who apparently Karzai pays off to the tune of at least $100,000 a month, is General Dostum.
Of course.
And he's famous for putting his prisoners in a pit, buried up to their necks, and driving 9-inch nails into their heads as he interrogates them. So,
the thing to remember: all of these so-called warlords are essential war criminals. Even Ahmed Shah Massoud, who is frequently lamented as the loss of a great hero, even he was a war criminal. People don't realize, or if they did, they forgot, that if you were to go to Kabul on September 11th, 2001, the city was destroyed. The city was destroyed not by the Soviets from their occupation during the 1980s, but rather through the internecine warfare that was fought amongst the different so-called warlords, the Jung Bazi, namely the Northern Alliance under Ahmed Shah Massoud, as well as Hekmetyar, and of course Dostum was at that time aligned with Ahmed Shah Massoud. So again, this story is, you know, oddly enough, it's pretty old. In fact, even before 9/11, the United States had been paying off money to Ahmed Shah Massoud, trying to get him to cooperate with U.S. intelligence agents to try to operate against the Taliban and Mullah Omar. So in some sense, you know, from the beginning of conflict in Afghanistan, this war has been fought really with pallets of money coming in from the CIA.
In the case of Massoud, of course, he was double-dipping with the Russians.
Oh, absolutely. But when it came to the Taliban during this period, we were actually on the same side. The Russians and the Indians were supporting Ahmed Shah Massoud, as were we. So at least in that window of time, we largely wanted the same thing, which is to undermine the Taliban authority and to make sure that the Northern Alliance under Ahmed Shah Massoud remained stable and capable of resisting further Taliban pushes.
And, of course, Massoud was killed on the eve of 9/11.
Yep.
So, again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So, the initial question is, of course, what did this money get us? The broader question is, what has the billions in treasure and the thousands of lives and the hundreds of thousands, perhaps, I don't know what the Afghan casualties have been, what has that gotten us?
Okay, so answering the question very narrowly, if you take the supposition that it is an inherent American interest that the Karzai government remain in place, that Karzai not be assassinated, for example, then you will pretty much take for granted that there needs to be a way of Karzai paying off these various patronage networks to keep these folks loyal to him and to keep at least his enemies on the payroll, right? So if you believe that Karzai is central to this entire effort, then it's really not difficult to imagine how it is that enabling him to make these patronage payments would be in the service of U.S. interests. All right, so narrowly, that's not so crazy to me. This is largely how, you know, people deal with strong men. And in some ways, you know, that's what Karzai is. But I think if you look at the larger question, this is where one cannot help but be cynical. There's really nothing that we've built in Afghanistan that is not reversible. We know about the industrial strength corruption. So in some sense, the CIA payments so that he can pay off foes and friends alike, they really pale in comparison to the industrial strength corruption. So on the one hand, while Karzai has to pay off these folks to make sure that he remains in place, what's perhaps less appreciated is that he's also overseeing this vertically integrated extraction mechanism where money comes in at lower levels of governance, perhaps through USAID contracts, through money spent at the provincial reconstruction teams, through the commander's emergency response program or what have you. And whereas in a patronage system, money gets paid down so that you're paying off your patrons, right? What Karzai has also erected is this the opposite infrastructure, where money is being extracted from lower levels to increasingly higher levels, and then it's being ferreted out of the country. And so in some sense, what we've done is we've subsidized a very luxurious Plan B for Karzai and his allies. You know, these monies have largely gone to Europe. They've gone to Dubai. And this has been well documented by the U.S. Treasury. I mean, we know that the money that's being ferreted out of Afghanistan on a daily basis is far in excess of the actual monies that the state itself is capable of generating.
Well, surely, though, at some point or other, perhaps when we start pulling out, there'll be some kind of reckoning. Do you think there will be in terms of the lives lost, the treasure wasted?
No, there'll be no reckoning. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, this Koinista fantasy, and you and I have had numerous discussions about this over the last several years.
That's the counterintelligence.
Yes, the counterinsurgency mafia. You know, they were so insistent upon promoting the surge in Afghanistan. They promised up and down that with just, you know, 40,000 more troops, we can defeat the Taliban and so forth. We have yet to see any of those individuals who are, as far as I'm concerned, are just rank scoundrels. They've not been held to account. And not only that, they're being given the opportunity to rewrite history even as we experience it. So all of them are penning memoirs explaining how it wasn't that their idea was flawed, it's but that the execution was flawed. It's just ridiculous. The idea from the get-go was a bad idea. So I don't anticipate seeing any sort of reckoning, if for no other reason than every year Congress had to continue funding this fiasco. And for there to be a reckoning, that would essentially mean that Congress would have to take a look at how this happened, given the fact that for much of this war, you know, it was done under continuing resolutions. There were numerous opportunities for Congress to weigh in on this, and yet Congress kept writing the check. So I don't think there's going to be any accountability. But the question that really does arise is the end game after 2014. We've built this massive state in Afghanistan. Even when the Soviets left, the state that they had built was substantively smaller, and they were paying a smaller fraction of the recurring costs to Najibullah when they left. So what we have built is this massive overgrown state, and we're paying almost all of the recurring costs. So this raises the question of what happens to, for example, the Afghan National Security Forces. Who knows what the exact number is, because, again, there's no genuine accountability on that issue. But when the ANSF doesn't get paid, what will they do? They'll basically collapse around their different commanders, who are in many cases warlords. And so essentially what will happen if we don't continue paying the recurring costs of the ANSF is that we've kind of written this future history of the next civil war with these different ANSF commanders breaking out, forming their own militias and going at it as they sort of divide up the spoils of, you know, in some sense a retrograde state.
But Chris Fair, will that happen whether we pay them or not? In other words, I don't believe the Obama administration is advertising the fact that when the boots on the ground have left, we're still going to be making these massive payments. So there are two questions. One, is this what's going on, that under the radar we'll keep paying for this quagmire in Afghanistan? And two, will the cash make any difference, whether or not they revert back to warlordism and chaos?
Okay, so that's the key question. So as I said, with respect to Najibullah, the reason why he was able to stay in power, even though the troops left, was that the Soviets were paying him. And he wasn't using those funds to feather his own nest. In fact, he was paying those funds to keep key facilities of the state operational. For example, he made sure that the security forces were getting paid. He made sure that key officials in the Ministry of Interior were getting paid. that's how Najibullah was able to survive, even though there were no Soviet troops. When that money was cut off, his regime fell, and the country lapsed into this internecine warfare amongst the different warlords. The problem that we have with Karzai, and if I were confident that Karzai were Najibullah, and let's remember, Karzai's term ends in 2014. We're going into uncharted territory. We don't know what an Afghanistan looks like without Karzai, unless he does something really bizarre that allows him to remain as president. It's not going to be Karzai in the presidency in 2014 when we withdraw. So we're really in uncharted territories. As I said, Karzai does two things. He takes the CIA and Iranian, although we don't think they're still paying the Karzai government, as well as any other tranche of funds, and he pays off certain people. But what Karzai has really built is this vertically integrated money hoover that sucks up money from the lowest levels and yanks it out of the country. So paying, continuing to allocate money to pay the recurring costs of this gigantuan sort of out-of-control rentier state only makes sense if we think Karzai and his, well, actually his replacement, is going to use those monies to pay off the key elements of state that need to be paid off to keep the place from falling into chaos and civil war. If Karzai were to be in that position after 2014, I would not be optimistic that the U.S. writing those checks would, in fact, secure regime stability, because everything that we've seen from the Karzai government has been about taking money from the international community and sucking it out of Afghanistan and putting it into... And by the way, Karzai is not the only one who does this. The Taliban have done this too. Everyone has their poppy palaces in Dubai, throughout the Gulf and in Europe. So I think the question of whether or not the United States should continue paying the recurring costs of the government will in large measure depend upon whether or not the person who's in place in 2014 is going to run a patronage network or whether he's going to run a vertically integrated hoover to take the money out of Afghanistan to feather nests elsewhere. And I think it's just really too early to say because, as I said, we're really moving into uncharted waters in a post-Karzai Afghanistan.
Again, Chris Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So since Karzai and his cronies have sent their money to Dubai and elsewhere, what incentive do they have to stay if the going gets tough?
They have no incentive. I mean, they'll be on the penultimate helicopter out of the country. And so he has no incentive to stay. In fact, if I were Karzai, I would abdicate I would vacate the presidency before my term even ended. Leaders don't, you know, he will be the first president to actually step down from a position of power voluntarily if he should serve out his term. So, you know, if Karzai actually is planning on staying in Afghanistan, he has taken none of the steps that would suggest that he has created an environment in which he can survive. I think that's why he's been largely, not just him, his entire family, his entire patronage network, have been really building this plan B outside of Afghanistan. Now, you know, if we could have thought this through in the beginning and could we have built some regime that would have denied him asylum or access to an exit visa, but I don't think that's legal. We may have forced him to sleep in the bed in which he has made. But, you know, under the prevailing legal regime that governs international community, no, he has feathered his bed elsewhere, and I suspect that's where he's going to go when he's no longer in power.
And he tried to sort of finagle these elections and find a way to stay on, but surely he's in a position to find some handpicked successor, doesn't he?
No, well, yes and no. So he can't stay on. Per the Afghan constitution, the president is limited to two terms. Mm-hmm. His first term was, of course, as interim president. So unless there's a constitutional amendment, he can't contest the elections again. There was some speculation that he had been massively rigging the provincial elections that took place in 2010 in hopes that he would get a compliant parliament that would push through an amendment that would allow him to contest a third time, but that didn't come to fruition. in part, you know, you don't have political parties per se in Afghanistan, so it's actually very difficult to get a consensus on anything, coercively or non-coercively. So I don't really think that's an option. In terms of him picking a hand-picked successor, you know, Afghanistan is a really difficult electoral environment. The first-past-the-post system makes it very difficult to actually have elected officials that officials who actually have a reasonable level of support in their different constituencies. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, what you really have to have in the successor is someone who is going to be a Pashtun, who will bring along the South, someone who's not going to be terribly punitive towards the Taliban. And then, of course, you need to have someone that can also work with the ethnic Tajiks and Uzbeks. And it's really not so straightforward coming up with an individual who can really satisfy these different conflicted electorates.
Well, just in closing, Christopher, what's happening vis-a-vis the exit, the physical exit of all that material, which, of course, is not going to amount to anything in terms of nation building? You've made that case. It's a rentier state, and it's no better or worse off than it was. Except, I guess, there's some more palaces in Kabul than there
Dubai.
Was,
and or also Kabul, yes,
and Dubai. There is so much war material there that the Pakistanis have been gouging the U.S. in terms of getting it out. I believe they've developed a route through the stands. So where does that stand in getting all of that that equipment out?
Well, I think what's going to happen very quickly is that there's an increasingly sobering of the decision-making about what we're going to get out of Afghanistan and what we're simply going to leave in place. You know, anyone who's been to Afghanistan sees that the countryside is literally littered with tanks, armored personnel carriers. You know, the detritus of the Soviet war is still completely present in Afghanistan, not to mention, I might add, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of mines. The number of mines in Afghanistan is absolutely staggering. I think when the Americans began thinking about withdrawal, the intention was to not do a redux of the Soviet Union and basically leave all of this crap in place. But it costs money to get that stuff out. And as you said, our relationship with Pakistan is very much deteriorated. The idea is that we don't want to send any sensitive material through Pakistan, both because we fear that it's going to be pilfered and used by the terrorist groups in Pakistan, which are numerous and expanding, it seems, on a daily basis. And the route through the stands, the so-called northern route, is incredibly expensive because ultimately, You've got to be able to stick stuff on a boat. And so getting stuff to the stands requires multiple agreements with multiple countries. And at the end of the day, this is really a NATO-Russia pissing match. So we're kind of trading off one problem for another problem. And then obviously moving the stuff out through air routes is prohibitively costly. So we already saw them make the announcement last week that the mine resistant, what is it, the MRAP, the mine resistant ambush protected vehicle, which really saved a lot of lives in Afghanistan, are going to be left in place. Part of it is because the Americans don't anticipate being in another theater where they need the MRAPs, but also getting them out is going to be incredibly expensive.
Well, Chris Fair, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. And we're going to continue this conversation in a moment after a break with the CIA's former station chief in Kabul.
Read it all. And where's all the money gone? Where's all the money gone? Or have I got things added up all wrong? Did she break the little nest egg that I was sitting on? Where's all the money gone? Where's all the money gone?
President talks to God. Do they drink near beer and go play golf while they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade when the president talks to God. When president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not? That voice is just inside his head.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his most recent book, Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And since last week, with the opening of the Bush Library, the George W. Bush Library in Texas, attended by five living presidents, there's been some revisionist history about Bush's legacy. But given what's happening in for example, in Iraq, following our intervention at the very moment, Iraq appears to be poised to resume a civil war. And in Afghanistan, where the U.S. is going to withdraw in 2014, the country looks like it will revert to a civil war. So the sort of futility and failure of this seems to be fairly manifest.
Well, it's certainly a total failure from the perspective of imposing America's preferred solution upon both of these countries, and in the case of the Bush administration, establishing American geopolitical presence, which would continue to dominate for the rest of the century. That was really their grand ideal of, you know, permanent military presence in the heart of Central Asia and Afghanistan that could then intimidate Russia and China and help maintain American hegemony there. So that's all collapsed. On the other hand, I'd have to say that I think some of these internal struggles are essentially inevitable in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere until some kind of power resolution is reached among the parties. And I believe that the U.S. presence is counterproductive in nearly every case in allowing the natives and local peoples to really solve these things on their own, even if it's going to take a little bit of violence. Otherwise, it's just one more imposed pro-American dictator that that just enrages populations and gives us what we've got.
But it does seem, and I believe our allies have come to this conclusion, that the U.S. is a spent force in the Middle East. And, of course, the American public, I think, have quite rightly and wisely had enough. I think that's restraining any intervention in Syria, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of an extreme statement to say that the United States is a spent force, but the idea that the United States will be the dominant determinant of everything that goes on in the Middle East now really does represent a fading pipe dream and something that we should abandon as fast as possible. But obviously, the U.S. is a major power, militarily unrivaled, economically significant, diplomatically skilled, or let's say a huge diplomatic presence, even if often unskilled in the way it's conducted itself. So in that sense, I think the U.S. will be a player, but I hope it's going to be a modest player. And believe it or not, I think some of Obama's ideas, such as leading from behind or allowing regional players to take a greater role or simply allowing some of these things to unfold on their own, is not a bad policy and a marked departure from where we've been before for the past 50 years or so.
But since George W. Bush, things got appreciably and precipitously worse, did they not? I mean, the intervention in these Muslim lands, which in many ways was right out of bin Laden's playbook, it feels like a hopeless fanatic goaded us into an endless war. And now we've got, you know, tremendous, we've riled up a billion people.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you on that, Ian. If the goal had been modest in either case of intervention, you could begin to maybe make a case for it. I think the case of Bush Sr. In the determination to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait was one such military intervention that was restricted in goals and quite successful. But the war to remake the world in our image, and especially not just democracy, but it was to establish American geopolitical power, unchallenged power in those areas, that was represented to me the huge overreach, and for which we're paying a bitter price now, and it's far from over.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his most recent book, Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. So given that you can't undo history, and it would seem in retrospect that the less footprint we have in that part of the world, the better off we are and would have been. But it seems to me, though, that there's going to be – I don't know whether the worst is yet to come. But if my understanding is that even when the Assads fall, largely at the hands of what's being loosely called al-Qaeda in Iraq, the al-Nusra Front seem to be the most effective amongst the rebels – the assumption, I think, is it not that this will embolden the Sunni in the west of in Anbar in Iraq and drive this fissure even deeper between the Sunni and the Shia? And at this point, some analysts have told me that that Maliki is basically just the mayor of Baghdad, that the place is a tinderbox, and the Kurds haven't been getting any of their oil money. So isn't Iraq... aren't we going to see round two in Iraq?
I think Iraq is far from settled its sectarian problems between Shia and Sunni. But Ian, let's face it, any time you have an opening towards more democratic representative government in many of these states, you are going to have sectarian tensions are going to burst out into the open. These are unresolved power tensions. It's not that these people haven't lived together with more or less peacefully or with some good and bad moments for centuries and centuries, but the question of power has never been resolved on any kind of representative democratic basis. When you have Shia, who are the dominant element in Iraq, then you don't need to be very bright to see that any kind of democratic practice is going to bring them to predominant power and reduce Sunni power accordingly. Now, both Sunnis and Shia are going to have to learn to live with this. For the first time, living with it openly in a more mixed government. I think the Shia so far have, and especially Maliki, have acted first of all to shore up the power that they now have gained for the first time in history, in which they feel legitimated in having it, and they're very suspicious of Sunnis. I think that those Shiite policies have been unwise, and Maliki's policies have been very unwise, far too exclusive. But the Sunnis obviously would prefer to win back all power, even as a minority, as it was under Saddam Hussein. So a lot of shaking down here, yes. I think people are going to need to do that on their own. And having American troops there does not improve the situation, because then each side simply deals with the United States as its card in the game, thereby pushing down the road any willingness to come to terms with each other.
Well, the good news, of course, is that, that Obama got the troops out. But surely the bad news is that rather than this country healing, outside forces embroiling it in a kind of surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia and by extension Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Israel. Isn't that what's going on in that region?
Sure. Everybody has taken advantage of this to one extent or another. I think now Iraq is beginning to be more or less able, is as it were, fighting on its own. I don't see that external intervention as anywhere near as intense as it was earlier on. But yeah, the shakedown process, as I said earlier, is going to be take quite a bit of time. The Syrian angle is even more anguishing because, as you know, this is the ultimate no-win game, if I ever saw one in the Middle East. Lose-lose on all sides, no matter who wins. It's essentially a loss for everybody else, and even the winner is unclear. So, at this point in the Syrian mess, it's very hard to know what Washington should do. If we intervene with military force, then we're falling right back into the same old trap, right in the middle of a civil war in which everybody plays us off against the others. And now, if no one intervenes in a situation that's gotten very ugly, it's no telling how much of a gain the extremist jihadists will make in that.
Well, we've got Libya as a kind of a precursor, don't we, in the sense that we brought down the dictator, but the place is in chaos. You've got these kind of Mad Max groups of militias driving around, encircling government ministries. Basically, it's a black hole, but Syria could be Libya, on steroids.
Sure. In the case of Libya, the situation is extremely messy, but I don't think I wouldn't put it on a par with Syria in the sense that we are not witnessing right now massive sectarian Sunni Shiite clashes in quite the same way. Mm-hmm. Libya is going to have to shake down as well. When is the eastern part of Libya going to learn to live with the western part and to manage, administer the country wisely? I have no idea how long that's going to take, but they really have to do it on their own. Nobody else can do it for them. In Syria, the outcome now with the jihadi forces coming in from the outside is really the perfect storm. And as I say, I think it's a no-win situation, but my gut instinct at this point tells me they sort of have to work it out on their own. But everyone has got a finger in the pie now.
Well, Graham Fuller, again, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council and former CIA station chief in Kabul, and his most recent book is Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. Just back to given the revisionist history about the Bush administration and even suggestions now from Republican pundits and Fox News that Bush kept us safe and Obama did not, referring to the Boston bombers, of course, selectively omitting 9/11 in that calculus. What about the possibility of a future blowback from our failed and futile interventions in Muslim lands, given that people are so riled up in those countries, particularly over the drones, etc.? Are we going to be visited by more and more of these kind of freelancers like the Boston bombers?
Well, we've been talking about this for years, including you and I on various at various stages as we've watched all of this unfold. I've never seen the Muslim world, and I've lived and worked there, as you noted, for nearly two decades. I've never seen it at such a high boil as it is now, and that's understandable when you've got war and military conflict in four or five countries in which the U.S. is involved in one degree or another in nearly every case. Then, of course, there is going to be blowback. If you will, and I've argued this before, that 9/11 was the blowback. I think most Americans, or even Westerners, tend to think of 9/11 as a blast out of the blue. Far from it. If you live in the Middle East, you can see this as really the logical culmination of decades of dissatisfaction with bitter dissatisfaction with American policies, and then going back earlier to British imperial policies. Of course, you know, if people are unhappy, it's not going to be the moderates that are going to rise up and rebel and strike. It's going to be the most radical force. So the question to me about 9/11 is, why didn't it happen earlier, or why should we assume that those forces are now spent or satisfied or feel that they've done what they wanted to do? Their number one goal, I viewed bin Laden and al-Qaeda as despicable. It's attack, direct attack, purely on civilians is an outrage, a criminal outrage, a moral outrage. But I don't think this kind of thing is going away as long as Muslims are still losing their lives in bombings, in bombings by the U.S., which are still continuing in Afghanistan, and now drones, which may have usually less people dead in each case, but still building up a huge legacy of anger and hatred that doesn't go away. Even if al-Qaeda has been largely diminished or destroyed in its headquarters in Afghanistan, as you say, it's the ACT alone bombers and terrorists that are the most scary, because they can't even be tracked institutionally.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his most recent book, Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the president's remarks today on the 150th anniversary of the National Academy of Sciences.
The newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triumph, an articulate liar.
Find a woman, oh baby, then you'll find love. And don't forget some, there is someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Cohen, who is a correspondent with Science Magazine and has also written for The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, Smithsonian, Outside Slate, Technology Review, Discover, The Washington Post, New Republic, Glamour, and Surfer. His books include Coming to Term, Uncovering the Truth About Miscarriages, Shots in the Dark, The Wayward Search for an AIDS Vaccine, and Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforests, Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Cohen.
Thanks so much for having me.
And today, President Obama promised to ensure that scientific research will be insulated from partisan politics as he spoke at the National Academy of Sciences celebration of its 150th anniversary. And I think that without doubt he was referring to what Lamar Smith, the Texas Republican, who's chairman of the House Committee on on science, space, and technology has recently done in demanding that the National Science Foundation justify its research. Is this a new round in the war on science?
No, not at all. This is politicians have been trying to muck with how the money that they appropriate gets spent forever. I think Obama's defense of allowing the peer review process to work and allowing evidence to guide what scientists do is very sane, and it's something that we should all be applauding. At the same time, it's nothing new for politicians to try to mess with the system that's working.
But can Lamar Smith get away with it? In other words, can he impose his regime and override the peer review process, which is apparently the intention of his law?
Well, every time that Congress has tried to do that, they've been pilloried. They've been hammered for trying to do it. And even if it does happen, it probably, I would predict, get undone pretty quickly. So, yes, it certainly could happen, but the outcry will be loud and fierce.
So, but when you say this has been going on for some time, Tom Coburn, of course, has been at the National Science after them for some time as well, saying that they can't, he doesn't like them doing research on political science. How much of this, though, is based upon the congressman and the senator's religious beliefs? Because both, I certainly know that Tom Coburn is an extremely religious fundamentalist Christian. I don't know about Lamar Smith.
Well, I think the tension between religion and science leads to this conflict in politics again and again. And we've seen it with everything from attempts to link breast cancer to abortion, attempts to, with President Bush, he created this great program for AIDS relief in developing countries, but said that we couldn't fund things that encouraged women who were selling sex or that encouraged people who use needles. So we see the intersection of religion and science all the time leading to this problem. I don't know in these specific cases whether that's the driving force, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, this has been going on for decades. And, you know, the federal government really ramped up its funding of science after World War II with a very noble pursuit, and that was let industry do what industry does, but basic fundamental research that is high risk is what the federal government wants to support. And that's kind of an easy target for politicians because you can't often prove that what you're funding leads to something practical.
Well, there's also, I think, isn't there the element of pork barrel? I mean, in all things that Congress do, I mean, at the moment, for example, the Army is saying, we don't want any more tanks. Right. And the congressmen from the districts that build this tank want more tanks, even though the Army doesn't want them. So we know that goes on. But I recall at the time when they were talking about building the giant accelerator that has operated in Switzerland now, that looks into the very origins of matter itself, that was going to be built. I can't remember where it was going to be built, but didn't they? Then some group of congressmen in Texas decided to move it down to Texas. So can you have can it work for science as well as work against us, the congressional interference?
Well, I mean, yes, it can if there's an advocate for something to happen. And I mean, look at Kennedy and the moon launch. Certainly, scientists can benefit greatly by political action. And, you know, the Clinton administration doubled the budget of the National Institutes of Health. It made an enormous difference. But I think at the core, there has to be a belief in the scientific credo that peer review is like democracy. It's not perfect, but it's better than any other system, and that we have to let evidence guide us. And once you start rejecting those two principles, which is what's been happening lately, then you run into just a world of trouble. And I think something that Americans should keep in mind is we're better than a lot of countries, you know, at separating what essentially is like a church and state separation. We're better at it. But, you know, obviously we're not perfect.
Sure. Well, again, I'm speaking with John Cohen, who's a correspondent with Science Magazine, and his books include Coming to Terms, Uncovering the Truth About Miscarriage, Shots in the Dark, A Wayward Search for an AIDS Vaccine, and Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. But if you are, though, if you have deeply held religious beliefs like Tom Coburn does, then... And you know, you don't believe in evolution. You believe in creationism. That's just fundamentally a irreconcilable position vis-a-vis science, isn't it?
Certainly. And we tolerate a diversity of opinion in this country. So he's allowed to believe that, and he's allowed to tell his constituents that's what he believes. And at the same time, we as a society have to speak up vocally when people who have opinions that violate the logic of science and the evidence-based notion, that we get vocal about it. And, you know, I think that's what's been happening the last few weeks. I think Obama was vocal about it today. That's what has to happen in this society.
Right, but it's one thing. But John, it's one thing to believe something, and it's another thing to be in a position of power where you can impose your beliefs on others. I mean, that's happened, you know, for example, with the Texas textbooks. You know, they're forcing the teaching of creationism. They're imposing their views, and it seems to me that maybe this is what Lamar Smith is doing as well.
But we don't have a First Amendment for science. There's no there's no document, there's nothing in our system that guarantees these things and holds them up as truths that are inalienable or rights or anything like that. This is a battle that has to be fought again and again with illogic and with people who are going to try to force their own views on a community of scientists who are essentially in complete agreement about how things should work.
But just specifically in terms of what Lamar Smith has the congressman who's in charge of the House Science and Technology Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, in his letter to the NSF and the bill that he's putting forth called the High Quality Research Act, one of the things in the bill is that Smith does not want to – he wants to ensure approved projects are not duplicative in terms of NSF funding, even though scientific research is by nature meant to be replicated, right? I mean, that's what it – you know, that's a scientific method, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. It's ridiculous. And redundancy is important, and the whole idea of verifying experiments with your own hands and your own laboratory is the essence of leading to credible evidence. So, I mean, how do we address ignorance in this country on any level? That's all it is. It's pure ignorance. And we see it in many realms outside of the world of science. We see it in the way that we make military decisions as well, or any other, you know, major decisions we make. When there's ignorance, what can you do? You just have to be extremely vocal about it and call it what it is, and it's ignorance.
Well, but one of the problems is with the convention in our press of equal and opposite arguments, you know, the binary way our press is structured with thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and the pro and con argument and giving them equal value, that I think has led to the idea that creationism is equal to evolution and more to the point, I think, that global warming denial is just the other side of the argument. You know, you got to have both sides of the argument.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think some journalists are very guilty of trying to be even-handed about things that we shouldn't be even-handed about. I mean, in South Africa, I've covered the AIDS epidemic for 25 years. the president of the South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, said that he wasn't convinced that HIV was the cause of AIDS. His country had more HIV than any country in the world. He allowed, under his watch, hundreds of thousands of people to become infected or to not receive treatment and die who could have been helped by scientific events. This is happening everywhere. It's outrageous, and it's harming us as people. And, you know, all I can say to the journalists I work with is, I'm going to write about your nonsense, and you're going to do it on the radio, and we're all going to collectively try to self-correct those problems. And journalists who are not good at their craft, or just like doctors who aren't good at their craft, or any other profession, when they're not good at their craft, they need to be exposed. And it's our job as journalists to point it out.
Well, but for one who has spent a lot of time with scientists, John Cohen, I mean, what I find, and I have some friends who are scientists, the one thing I find about them is that they're incredibly conservative, that they don't make rash statements, that they don't make rash promises. And that's what I find so extraordinary, the idea that the global warming deniers are saying that these scientists are making stuff up. That just doesn't happen, right?
Well, you know, the beauty of science is that it's open to new ideas, and the notion is that we only know what we know today. Everything is topical knowledge, and that's a beautiful thing that people can easily exploit. You can take advantage of scientists because they aspire to be open-minded, and that's what happens. And so, yes, they are in some ways sitting ducks. They're asking for it because their credo is, I only know what evidence I have. So you can introduce doubt everywhere. But, you know, we can forcefully say certain things with evidence that stop arguments. We now have antiretroviral drugs that allow people to live for decades who have HIV. That's a pretty strong argument that science delivered on the notion that HIV causes AIDS. So stop it. Just stop it. And well, I think we need to do the same things with, you know, with climate change and anything else that's just illogical. Hit it with evidence.
Well, Jeff Cohen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Cohen, who is a correspondent with Science Magazine and has also written for The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, Smithsonian, Outside, Slate, Technology Review, Discover, The Washington Post, New Republic, Glamour, and Surfer. His books include Coming to Term, Uncovering the Truth About Miscarriage, Shots in the Dark, The Wayward Search for an AIDS Vaccine, and Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.